I appreciate John coming today. This is kind of a true grit test for me, because John's the guy that helped me incorporate a lot of what I'm going to try to pass on to you today. And so it really is a privilege for me to talk to you guys. I genuinely want to communicate to you that I'm trying to put these principles in practice in my own life. And so incorporated here are many of the things that I have done for me personally and that I'm working on. And it occurred to me as kind of a prelude to getting started some time ago that the Navigators were never going to invite me to go on staff. And having realized that, it then occurred to me, if I was going to make a multiplying disciple-making ministry, which is what I wanted to do, then I would have to figure out and bring together whatever had to be brought together in order to develop a multiplying disciple-making ministry. And so what you're going to see today is, by and large, pretty much my distilled thought process as I have gleaned stuff from the Navigators, men like John Repass and Gene War, and then tried to put it into a format that can work. So that's kind of where we're going to go. And let me mention to you that we're going to have three practical exercises today that I'm going to want you to participate in. One is developing a ministry purpose statement, okay, defining and describing what it is that you feel God is leading you to do. And then secondly, begin to define your own ministry map, which will be to help you get beyond conceptualizing the ministry to actually begin to start putting some real teeth into what you're trying to do. And then thirdly, begin to identify for you, at least get you to agree with me, that what you have already is the beginnings of a toolkit of stuff you can use to make disciples in the marketplace. This is stuff you've already seen, and most of us, because we've been so familiar with it, we lose the perspective that these are actually tools we can employ. So I'm going to try to bring that up so you can see it today. And as you see, I'm going to ask you from the beginning to start thinking about your application, specifically what impressed me most, where do I fall short, and what by the grace of God do I intend to do about it this week. So I want you to feel free that as we go through this material and this talk, I want you to come back to this front page and put down, okay, this impressed me, and oh, this is where I have a shortfall, and this is what I will do about it. Okay, so this will be try to get you to be very application-oriented. Well, let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll get into this. Father, thank you for the privilege of being able to serve these men today by sharing what you're doing in my life, and the fact that the Holy Spirit living in us is going to energize us to help us do what you want us to do your will. So I pray today, Lord, as we do some left brain thinking about the ministry, that you'd give us a challenge, that you'd give us an application for our lives. In Jesus' precious name we pray, amen. Guys, I want to start off by by thinking about the ministry a little bit. And I had been persuaded for a long time to believe that the foundational verse in disciple-making was Matthew 28:18-20, which I'm sure every one of you knows, says, go therefore and make disciples. And I was persuaded that that would be the focus point of the ministry verse for me and in my ministry for making disciples, until about 2 years ago when I came across Matthew 9:36-37. And you probably know that Jesus is speaking, and he's speaking to his disciples, and he's saying that he's telling them to look out at the harvest field, that it's white for harvest. And then he says to the disciples, therefore beseech the Lord of the harvest that he might send out laborers into his harvest. And it was like you know, being hit up by the side of the head. Why was Jesus speaking to the disciples, asking them to pray for laborers? And I started meditating on that, and a whole array of possible conclusions started coming to my mind. Why weren't the disciples laboring? Or were the disciples laboring? Why was Jesus asking them to pray for laborers from the Lord to go back into the harvest? I mean, all kinds of those questions came to my mind until I came to a realization for me. Making disciple wasn't the entire objective. It was making a disciple and I'm going to give you some terminologies that I have begun to start using in a plan that I have written for me to do the ministry. I've called this guy a fully functioning disciple, a disciple that is, in fact, fulfilling all the affirmative commands of Scripture, and he is able. He is able then to reproduce. And a laborer, as I started thinking about it, was a disciple who was then able and motivated to go into the harvest field and then be able to create a multiplying disciple-making ministry. And it occurred to me at that very moment, that is what I feel persuaded by God to do. Not stop with just raising up a disciple, but help that disciple to become motivated, become equipped, and become supported and sustained in the ministry. And those words that I just gave you, we're going to end today's session talking about those a little bit more. Because it's not just enough, it's not just adequate to make a disciple, guys. We've got to get the disciple into the marketplace, and then we have to sustain him in the marketplace so he can reproduce. And so our job isn't finished by just getting the guy to practice the basics, because we've got to get him launched. When I moved to Oklahoma City, and all of this is by way just of introduction, I moved to Oklahoma City and I said to the fellows there, I would like a mission. I would like for you to give me something to do. I want to go and take these things that I know, and I want to put some real teeth in them. And the guy that was helping me, by the way, it's John, said, okay, this is how he did it. We agreed that Oklahoma City University was going to be the mission field. He took me out on Monday night. As I recall, it was probably Monday night. And we knocked on about three doors, and then John left and said, bye-bye, here is your target. And there wasn't anything there. I mean, nobody had left me a key man to work with. There wasn't anything there except dormitories filled with students. But guys, that experience for me affirmed within me the conviction of disciple-making and these principles that I'm going to share with you today, which most of them, because I started off telling you that the navigators did not invite me to go on staff with them, which now I'm really quite grateful for, because instead of using their syllabus for what they're doing, I have written one for me, and it's been written on my heart. And so I'm going to be doing this stuff with these guys, not because somebody else has generated. I paid the price to figure this stuff out and to figure out how to get a guy from A to B to C and then figure out how to keep him sustained and supported in the ministry. So that's going to be what we're going to talk about. And to me, it began a few years ago by defining what I felt like God wanted me to do. And so today, a part of what we're going to do is I'm going to ask you to describe what God wants you to do. What is it specifically that God is leading you to do? And I'm going to have you define it in very specific terms. Secondly, I want to talk to you a little bit about focus. A couple weeks ago, I went to hear a fellow by the name of Herman Cain, who is CEO and chairman of Godfather's Pizza. He spoke at OSU Executive Management Committee meeting. Some of you may have attended some of those seminars. And the focus of the topic of his discussion was the success of focus. And Herman was, he grew up in suburbs of Atlanta, not the nice suburbs, but the ill-advantaged suburbs. And Herman's dad told him, Herman, you need to go to school and become something. And so Herman was sort of motivated. And over time, Herman, does anybody here know Herman? Has anybody heard him speak? Okay. Well, he's a fairly tall black guy, and he speaks with a thunderous, commanding voice. And when he says, I believe in focus, he really believes in focus, and you know that he believes it. Herman's quote was that, I want to become the president of something for somebody, somewhere. Before Herman ever knew of the opportunity within Godfather's Pizza, Herman became the president of Godfather's Pizza and then the CEO, and he's considered the pizza king in the fast food industry. And why? Because along the path, Herman decided to focus and concentrate on what he wanted to get accomplished. And guys, the reason I'm talking about focus with you today is because in my experience, I talk to guys almost every single day about business and about ministry. And I hear them say to me, I want to make disciples, but you know what I see? I don't see that. I mean, I hear them tell me that, but what I see is this committee they're on, and they got that activity, and this is competing, and all of a sudden I understand all of this other stuff they're doing, but they're not focused. They don't have a concentration and clear picture on what they're trying to do and what is the outcome that they're trying to achieve by the grace of God. Because their time, they may have defined it, but their time is allocated to everything else but that one thing. And guys, I don't want in my life to focus on all of the other stuff. I want to focus on building and training and equipping and motivating and leading and sustaining men in a multiplying disciple-making ministry where they are multiplying and they are sustaining the ministry. And that is what I see the objective of raising up disciples in the marketplace. To get there, we need to develop a bit of a map. We need to develop a bit of a framework in order for us to know how to go about doing that. And so we're going to talk about building a map. But to talk about the goal for just a moment, and to get you as quickly as I can to your first exercise, the goal of your ministry should be clear, it should be to the point, it should be succinct. I've given you mine. My goal is to identify, recruit, equip qualified laymen to walk with God, spiritually lead their families, and reproduce their faith in their sphere of influence. That is exactly, word for word, the goal statement written in my business plan for this disciple-making ministry I'm doing. That's it. And I have taken those words, identify, recruit, equip, qualified laymen, reproducing their faith, and I have outlined what I believe those criteria, those words, those phrases mean. And so, guys, as you start conceiving and developing what you believe God wants you to do, you need to be able to develop it with tremendous clarity so that you can develop focus on what you're trying to do. And then secondly is to know with clarity what the outcome is that you're expecting. This is the outcome that I wrote. This is the result that I'm expecting of the labor that I'm doing. The result will be 2 Timothy 2:2, able men who will be able to teach others also, motivated, committed, reproducing disciples who actively share their faith and invest their lives in others. And you may have to take several different attempts to describe this ministry you feel called to do until you get it so focused and so clear in your mind that you know exactly and precisely what you need to do. And I took time to try to do that, and I wrote it a number of times, and I asked people if I was way out to lunch or how far off the mark I was, and I got people to give me some input. I'm going to describe to you at the end of what we talk about today. We're going to talk about, at the end of the talk, how to develop and sustain for you a progression, what do I call it here, a personal growth development strategy. I think if you guys here don't have a way of you continuing a continual growth program for yourself, you're going to slide back. And we're going to talk about that some in business. It occurred to me that even though I wasn't in a specific Bible study with guys on a weekly basis, I needed a core group of men supervising what I was doing such that I knew that there was resources available for me in which to tap if I needed. Now, what I'd like to do, and I'm being intentionally brief on that one point so we can discuss it later, I would like you to take just a couple minutes, and I would like you to jot down in the box at the top of page 3 your written goal, how you perceive what you perceive to be the disciple-making ministry God is calling you to. And if you haven't kind of clarified it in those terms then in a little broader sense, what is it that you feel God is leading you to do in the ministry specifically? All right, let's take just a couple minutes and do that. All right, I think that what we'll try to do is move along. You may not have totally gotten it down, and you may have to write it a couple more times. Is everybody still writing? you've kind of gotten at least a stab at conceptualizing it, then kind of look up and give me a sense that most of everybody here is tracking. Well, the rest of you finish, I realize I did not tell you who I am. And let me introduce myself kind of while you're finishing. My name is Dan Williams, and I'm Vice President and Chief Financial Officer for American Fidelity International, which is an international investment company which is investing in third world countries, Russia, China. We're doing some work in the Czech Republic. Specifically, my responsibilities are for our Russian developed projects. So whatever is happening in the country of Russia falls under my responsibility. And I was sharing with some of you a little earlier today that last year I spent about 20% of my time in Russia last year and working with executives and business people over there. We are very fortunate with the country that we live in. And every time I hit Mother USA, I just praise God that I'm back in my own country. And I like the Russian people, but we have solved temporarily many of the problems that they are facing. And I know a lot of people, a lot of missionaries over there, and it is a difficult field. It is an extremely difficult field. For the most part, the Russian people are without a moral base from which to make any kind of decisions that you and I are going to be talking about in this workshop today. You have a moral base of understanding why these things are important. That escapes them for the most part. But the Lord's given me an opportunity to work with some of those folks over there, and I count it a privilege to be a representative for Christ there. So the things that I'm trying to tell you, that these are not just theoretical things to me, they're things that I am working on in my own business life. And so I can give you personal examples of how this stuff is working. All right, let's take just a moment and now, which of those goals could be easily met if we didn't have focus and concentration and some specific purpose and point in our minds to concentrate on achieving that? I mean, it became so clear to me, guys, I can't flirt around with all of the other stuff that's available for me to do. And I get calls just about every other week, Dan, we'd like you to serve on this board. And more than not, I've said to the majority of those guys, I don't have time to focus on that. And those are just illustrations that happen to every one of you guys all day long. And you could translate that into the church environment or the community environment or civil, the public service environment, and you guys would know exactly what I'm talking about. Once we develop a perspective, a concept, a statement about what we want to do, that doesn't get it done, right? I mean, that's like saying I want to be the president of something, someplace, for somebody. But until I do something, I don't get there, right? So I've got to do more than just conceptualize what I want to do. I've got to create a mechanism from which to get there. And this little tool that I'm going to give you, called Morate, is perhaps the best planning tool that I've ever used. And this would be qualified by saying that I've gone through a number of business planning courses in my professional experience, and I inevitably come back to this one because it's clear, and because it's concise, and because it's reproducible. You guys, after you leave here, will be able to reproduce this in your life. Why create a map of our ministry? Well, I put the globe on there because what we're trying to do is we've conceived of something that's so big, so massive, that we're going to find it difficult to get our arms around. How do I make a disciple? How do I go into the marketplace and try to recruit men out of the marketplace to disciple them? I mean, it looks almost incomprehensible to me to do. So getting my arms around it. Well, Morate is a way of boiling down what you're trying to do simplistically and clearly for you to accomplish. Here's what it means. The first thing we've already done, which is to define a ministry objective, to conceive of what we're trying to accomplish. Secondly, O is for opportunities. What are the opportunities available for me to do what I want to do? R is for resources. What are the resources that are available to me, and what are the resources that I need? Okay, I'm going to assume that when you guys decide you're going to make disciples, you have some resources already. I have some resources. I have Gene. I have John Crawford. I have Gene War. All these people living in Oklahoma City that I can call anytime I want. Is that all the resources I need? Probably not. I'm just not now aware of what other resources I need. I did figure out one resource I need. As soon as I got to Moscow, when I shared with this guy in Russia, I figured out quickly, what am I going to do with him once he becomes a Christian? And every time I've gone to Moscow, I have had dinner with this guy and shared the gospel with him every single time. But what's going to happen to him once he makes a decision for Christ? I needed a new resource. I didn't have a resource. I couldn't ask John to follow up Sergei or Andre in Russia, so I needed a new resource. So I figured out I could try to find some Campus Crusade people, and I could try to find some Navigator people, but I had to figure out there was new resources I needed. All right, A, activities. What are the activities that you're going to plan? And at least as important, what are the activities that other people have already planned you could be subject to? For example, this Key Man Conference doesn't happen in concert with my ministry. I mean, this Key Man's Concert happens every single year, whether I come or not, whether I lead a workshop or not. It's going to be here. So it's an activity that I have to consider in terms of what I'm trying to accomplish in my ministry. So don't think about just what you're going to plan. What else is going on in your total realm? And then next is timetable. You know what you're going to do, but this is where you consider when you're going to do it. When you're going to do it. And then lastly is evaluate the outcome. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about outcome, guys, because I know that there's been a lot of controversy about measuring disciple-making ministries. Some people say you can, some people can't say you can't, and there's been a lot of controversy over that. But you know, one thing you can measure is you can measure your own performance. You can measure that. I mean, if you make an objective that says, I'm going to share Christ 2 times a month, you can measure whether you met that goal or not. Okay? You can measure other outcomes. But the way you measure those other outcomes isn't objectively. You can't use the quantifying kind of measurements. For example, measure a guy's one quantifying way of measuring it is, one of my goals is to take every guy I disciple through the design for discipleship. That's a quantifiable way of measuring whether or not I have succeeded in part of my ministry. The more important measurement isn't whether he's gone through it, is it? It is where is he at relative to what he's applied. So now I have to find a way of deciding what are the subjective outcomes I need to be kind of looking for to see if taking him through design for discipleship was a useful experience for him or not. And so guys, what I'm trying to say to you is you're going to have to start consciously thinking about, there are some measurable ways of thinking about things, they're just not quantifiable things. They're just not quantifiable things. For example, quiet time. If you want to know how successful you are with a guy in his quiet time, just ask him to start sharing his quiet time experiences. Guys, that is a subjective way of understanding the outcome, right? So just a subjective way of understanding. So you don't have to boil stuff down to quantifiable measures, as long as you have an understanding of some of the subjective ways of understanding it. Does that sort of make sense? Sort of see where I'm tracking with some of this stuff? Okay. Any questions up to this point? I want to stop and I want to kind of give you an opportunity to ask some questions about this, or maybe dialogue about it. Maybe dialoguing is a little better way of describing this than just.
What was the difference on the mission statement and ministry objective? Is that the same?
Same thing. Same thing, Don. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Are you clear about the idea about opportunities? I've decided that for me, I've said to myself this year, I want to try to meet with executives in the business world who are men whose professions are firmly established and have their career handled. Okay, if I show you right here my 15-page written business plan for what I'm describing to you now, you'll see that in there. So what are the opportunities for me to try and develop that. Right? I have to think about what are the opportunities. Now, this gives rise to a whole array of creative thinking, guys. And you're gonna have to kind of lay aside some of the right brain thinking and start shifting into some of the left brain thinking. And I asked some guys, I presented an opportunity to what I consider kind of be, for lack of a better word, the board that I kind of report to. And these guys would not know that terminology because I've not used it with them, but that's how I view their role in me. I report to them in what I'm doing. And so I asked these guys what they thought about it. And I got some that thought it was a crazy idea, and some of them thought that it was a good idea, and the consensus of the group was, why don't you try it? And so I tried it. And I was just describing to one fellow today that the Lord, through this experience, has opened up the opportunity for me to work with a president of this one company. That is exactly what I was trying to get to. And had I not continued to try to focus on thinking of new thoughts, thinking of different ways of getting to the same goal, I would have remained in this paradigm, this box that I was in. So you've got to think about the opportunities that are available to you. When I decided to give up the international student ministry and shift over to ministering to men in the business world, I had absolutely no idea what to do. I was there, but I didn't know how to define what it was. I didn't know how to recruit a businessman to the vision. So that kind of thought process is what I'm trying to encourage you guys and exhort you guys to try to think through in yourselves. That's just an example of opportunities.
Okay. So I just want to kind of wrap that up in my own terms and maybe respond back to me as far as your key point on opportunities is when we're thinking about our goal is to kind of brainstorm in a sense, okay, where do I start? What have I been given with?
Yep.
The resources, who do I know?
Yep.
To kind of get, you know, like when you're trying to sell a deal,
yep.
Who's the decision maker? You're trying to figure out who's playing the game, who can get me to that guy, if it's the VP, the CEO,
yeah.
Or whoever.
Yeah.
And then you're going to run against some roadblocks,
yeah.
And you're saying the opportunities, okay, go back, rethink, re-transform,
yeah.
Okay, and just keep
yep.
Reevaluating. I guess what I'm trying to do.
Exactly.
The opportunities.
Exactly, Jim. Yeah, bud.
Can you just briefly share what this opportunity that you checked through with these guys and so here's what you did?
I don't mind at all. I was just trying not to be too specific just so that people wouldn't get hung up on a one deal. I was asked to serve on a committee of a Christian organization in Oklahoma City. And I made it real clear what my mission was that I want, and I made it clear to all of the leadership in this organization. And I said to them, I will do this for you, but I want you to know that my mission statement is to recruit, train, equip, support, sustain, multiplying disciples. And I won't do anything with you in your group that doesn't directly contribute to that goal. And I said to them, do you still want me? I gave them the opportunity to decide that I shouldn't be part. But I made it real clear what my agenda was. Because, guys, I am highly focused on this thing. And I wanted them to buy into what I could do for them. I didn't want to be involved in a lot of other stuff. So what I did is I figured out, where were the men in significant positions of leadership and career attainment in my city that I could go to, tap into, and try to recruit to disciple making? CBMCs, one of those organizations, Christian Business Committee. That's one example. But let me give another example, which is a little bit more down to earth. I kept struggling with how do I get to business executives in my normal course of the day that I live? How do I get to them to, one, befriend them and show them genuine care and meet some of their needs, and then, two, create an opportunity for the gospel? How do I get to it? You know, guys, what I figured out was 4 days out of the five, I was having lunch with the vice president of this bank in Oklahoma City, the vice president of that bank, this chief financial officer of this company, I already had those business contacts. I just hadn't seen they were the opportunity. And I redefined. And I suddenly realized, okay, well, Matt's a guy that's a senior vice president in Bank in Oklahoma City. And I said, Lord, I really want to get to Matt. Help me figure out how to get to Matt. Matt is very interested in Stephen Covey's stuff. Okay? That's Matt's agenda. He's real interested in that. So I said to Matt, because see, I'm starting to know now how to kind of work this angle a little bit, because I'm Matt's customer, and Matt needs to make me real happy, because I borrow about $20 million from Matt every year, and so Matt, I'm real important to Matt, okay? Matt wants to take care of me. So I said, Matt, I'd like to have some tickets to go to see Stephen Covey. And so what I did is I figured out how to get into what Matt was interested in doing. Okay, rather than trying to get Matt interested in what I was doing, I tried to get interested in what Matt was doing. So Matt took me to Stephen Covey. The next week, I called Matt up and said, boy, I'd like to have lunch with you and talk about Stephen Covey. And we got together and we fellowshipped around the Lord and around the Word, and Stephen Covey never came up. It was an opportunity that I just needed to kind of figure out how to make work for me. And I'm convinced, guys, and whatever your business and whatever your profession is, you have those same kind of opportunities. You just haven't done enough left brain thinking about it and enough just outright experimentation to get those things figured out where they start working for you. Now, most of the evangelistic contacts I have were with people that I've targeted in banking industry and accounting industries that I call up to have lunch with me because I'm their customer. And when I'm their customer, I have a lot greater influence over what they want to do. So I've gotten all these guys now to sign up to go to CBMC Mayor's Prayer Breakfast in April the 3rd because they're going to hear the gospel there, and they're doing what they're doing in their business, what it needs to be done to make me, the customer, happy. Okay? You can figure that out too. That's what I mean conceptually about trying to develop opportunities. Let's go to resources. What about resources? What are the resources that you guys need in order to do the ministry that you want to do? Just kind of off the top of your head. I can tell you guys what the resources you need are, but I want you to tell me what they are.
Time.
Okay, you got to have time. All right. What else?
Materials like cassette tapes or video tapes or something to get.
Okay. All right. Okay, that's a materials kind of a question.
I was just thinking about time now. Maybe a heart to want to serve.
Okay.
Go in. Kind of resource. Thank you. You don't have a heart. You
have
to God to give you the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you seem to be wanting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's
resources yourself.
Okay. Resources myself.
Filling yeah. your cup.
Yeah.
That's a
huge one, Lonnie. Because if there isn't enough reserve in me, I ain't gonna have a lot to give out. So as soon as you become aware that you yourself need to be sustained and supported in the ministry. And I see a lot of guys who become lone rangers. And a little part of this talk that I'm going to give, I'm going to talk about that. But you and I aren't lone rangers. I mean, we're called into a race that a whole bunch of other people are running in. And we need to be supported and sustained and encouraged so that we can become a resource for the ministry God's calling us to. What other resources? Okay.
Draw on their wisdom, their counsel.
Yeah.
The multitude of counselors who can kind of say that it's a bad idea. According to your mission, no, this is a good idea. That will fly, maybe like that.
Yeah.
And kind of can be there to pick you up if you do fail, but also encourage you if you walk on and you're successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good, Brian. Okay, I think you're tracking on the idea of resources. Let's go to the next one. Top of page 4. What about activities? What kind of activities might need to be planned? Well, okay, let's put this in my context. Okay, what one activity should I focus on in the ministry I'm doing? You got it. You got it. All I have to do is focus on that one thing. Get as many lunches with my customers, with those people where I'm their customer as I can. All right? And when you hold $20 million that you can place with any bank in town, you're everybody's customer. Or you're everybody's wannabe customer. Yeah. I figured that that's all I needed to do. Because I could do evangelism, and I could do man-to-man at lunchtime just by swapping the appointment I had. Okay? And we're going to talk about corporate culture in just a minute, but I want to give you a flavor for how understanding corporate culture comes into right now. My company believes that I ought to be having lunches with people in the business world every day that I possibly can. Now, I don't know what you think about that, but I think about that as a corporate culture that supports the God-ordained ministry I believe I ought to be doing. Okay, so it's a little bit now of creating a seamless environment between where your ministry happens and where your career is happening. Okay. All right, so you kind of get the idea about activities? Now, I think about this Key Man Conference as an activity, and every year when John Crawford says it's going to be February so-and-so of 19 so-and-so, that date gets on my calendar right at that point because part of my ministry planning has already been done for me. I don't have to think about one conference because John's going to do the conference, and I just come and get the benefit of it. All right, let's go to timetable. What's that, Jim?
And bring a man.
Yeah, and bring a man. Right, exactly. James is here today in another guy's workshop because he knows that he's going to get as much of this as he wants. So he didn't have to be here. Okay, what about timetable?
Yeah. For your lunch.
This calendar, I would lose my ministry orientation without this calendar because it's got these guys lined up. Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay. What else?
Probably be helpful to establish some benchmarks of where you want to be with certain individuals to try to keep you on track.
Exactly. Yeah?
Yeah, I know. Kennedy puts out keeps a file. I know the guys he spends time with, and he makes a lot of notes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he probably keeps track of, okay, how we progressed
mm-hmm.
since the last time we met.
Mm-hmm.
And just logs the guys he works with.
Yeah. I'm going to give you an example of how I do some. This fellow is not here, and you won't be able to see this because it's not close enough to you, but I'm just going to give you an example of how do I stay on top of what I'm doing with the guys that I'm working with. This is a little report. You can get this stuff almost. You can do it in paper. You can do it in the computer. This is a little program called ACT. This is a contact database program, and it has a huge notes feature, and I schedule all my appointments on ACT, and so what it does is it creates a chronological log of every phone call I make and every appointment that I have, even appointments I have that I cancel or messages that I leave. It leaves a history chronology of what I've done with that guy. And so this page starts with June 1995, and Daryl and I quit meeting then, and it goes back to May 5th, 1994. And every single appointment, phone call that I made to Daryl is right there, or at least every major one. I know what I've done with Daryl. And then back here, it's got notes. Every time we made an appointment and had an appointment together, I made a little note of what Daryl and I did. Entry 6/1995. Reviewed four topical memory verses, pack A verses. We'll get with Greg this week. Okay, he will get with Greg this week. He was telling me about what he's going to do in his ministry. Send blank verse cards and write out the two EE questions on verse cards. That's what I was going to do and send to him because he was learning over the phone from me how to use the EE diagnostic questions because Daryl and I met every other Tuesday night. Daryl lives in Kansas City. I called him and we had a phone man-to-man session. We did this for a year and a half together. And I was going to send him that because I told him I would. And he was going to complete the detailed follow-up appointments. So I knew what was happening with Daryl. And you've got to find a way, guys, of keeping up with what you're doing with these fellows. Yeah. Another thing you can do is once you have quantified what you feel like a guy needs to do to become a disciple is to then create a list You know, this guy's done this, I've done this. You know, I have a list for follow-up. I have a separate list for discipleship. I have a separate list for a disciple maker. And as guys kind of go through, not that I take them through chronologically, because I try to find where the guy is and meet his need. That's how I've been able to recruit these guys, is because I don't take them through my agenda. I find out what their agenda is and do the best I can to serve them. But you have to think it through. The process of writing it down isn't so you can march them through it. It's so you think it through. It's so you've thought about it. John Crawford will tell you he doesn't have a profile on what a disciple is, because for 45 years, John Crawford's made disciples. But I ain't 45 years into this process. Yeah, I have to think it through on what Jesus meant when in John 15:8 it says, by this is my Father glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. I have to figure out what that means. And I have to get the guy that I'm working with to figure out what that means. Because he needs to know how to get the guy he's working with to figure out what that means. All right, evaluation, describing the outcome. Well, we've kind of talked a little bit, and we've kind of introduced, I use this as a calendar grid system, but I don't know any way, guys, of entering into effective ministry and not being able to adequately plan your time. One of the easiest ways to get a balance between either job and ministry or family and ministry is by not having some objective way of looking at what you're doing and measuring it against what you think you should be doing. For I'm not kidding you, and John is a witness right here, every Sunday night for probably 6 months, I took over to John's house a weekly schedule. Every Sunday night. Now, to my knowledge, I only missed that a very few times, and I brought it over on Monday morning, probably before he went to work. And John built into my life the concept of looking at what I'm doing. Okay, you need to have a weekly schedule. You need to have a record-keeping system of some point. And then you need some ability to review your goals. You have to do that. The thing I want to get across to you guys today is you need to be evaluating the outcome. All right? I want you to say that with me. You need to be evaluating the outcome. You need to be evaluating the outcome. Right? If you're not evaluating the outcome, you're not going to know. You won't have the mental discipline to say to yourself, where is Jimmy in the process of becoming a followed-up convert to becoming a multiplying disciple-maker, a multiplying laborer? You've got to take the discipline of doing that. Okay, I'd like to kind of jump subjects on you and have you turn over to page number 5. And I want to talk about creating credibility. And I want to talk about what's happening in the marketplace and talk about that a little bit, because it is so absolutely important to how you think about the ministry. First thing is that credibility is not given to you in the business realm. You don't get credibility because you happen to have taken a job in so-and-so company. You get credibility, or you build credibility, because you earn it inside the business where you're at. All right? It is not automatic. You earn it. You earn respect from people that work for you. You earn the respect. If you don't think that's true, all you have to do is find out who your secretary's best friend is, and then have somebody ask her what she thinks about you. All right? Because your secretary is, I mean, I know my secretary does. Yeah. They talk among each other. And the credibility I want, the way I measure the credibility, is what is my secretary saying about me when I'm not there to observe her words? Yeah. You know you've gotten credibility there. You know you've gotten a platform there. So that's an important thought just to have in your mind. But let's talk about the marketplace. What's important in business? Every business that I've known, there are a few exceptions that would probably not be business, but every business that I know of, every viable business, is there for one thing, at least primarily one thing, and that's for profit. And I deeply appreciate Gene's comments that we may make a whole bunch of money, we may give it to the Lord, but we're in business to make money. There isn't any question about that. And guys, in this talk that I'm giving you today, I want one thing to be absolutely clear. When I'm on the work site, my boss is getting 110% out of what I can do. And the best talents I can muster, he's getting those from me. And this past week, I was kind of probing my boss just a little bit about what kind of bonus expectation there might be for this year. And he said to me, he said, don't worry about it. You've far exceeded my expectations. So it was good to know that the product that I think I'm giving to him, he is also receiving it in that same way. But we need to be given the people that we're working for the best that we can give. The next concept there is that, in at least in my experience, more than likely in most businesses, particularly corporate America, they're going to be non-Christian managers. And you need to know that, because how you relate to them is directly impacted on their hostility factor. Let me give you an example. Some of the darkest days, at least in my business career, were back when I was a CPA for a national accounting firm. And that's when I got to Oklahoma City. And I was witnessing literally to every single person I could and on the job site. And unbeknownst to me, I was creating some problems from some employees. And so one of the senior partners in the office came to me and said, you need to cut this out totally, because if I ever hear of you talking about Jesus Christ again with anybody for any reason, period, end of story, you won't be with this firm any longer. So my problem was I did a really poor job figuring out what the culture was. And I went into it blind. Now, I appreciate the opportunity for suffering for Jesus' sake, but I think I could have probably done a better job of managing the outcome had I been aware of that. Today I work for a guy who, when we're out traveling, he introduces me as, this is Dan Williams, he's the greatest Christian I know, and he would like to talk to you for a minute. Do you have time? Yeah. I just don't have to worry about trying to talk with guys about Christ, because he's given me the introduction. And you have to figure out what your platform is, what your culture is you're dealing with. Thirdly is, guys, no matter whatever else you may think about business, and if you own a business today, I hope I don't step on your toes just too much, but I want to tell you today that, guys, there is no contract today with you in the workforce. Okay? It may have been yesteryear when you joined a company and you work for that company for life, but today that does not exist. Generally speaking, in corporate America, your contract with that company is until they find a cheaper, better way of getting that service provided, and then you are a disposable asset. And that is how corporate America is working today. That's resulted in shorter career horizons, and it has also necessitated the fact that you and I must stay in a constant state of self-improvement. Take the next item as an example. We are in the midst of a technology revolution. We're absolutely, literally every 15, 16, 17 months, they're finding a way to double, triple, or quadruple the amount of data they can store in an electronic fashion. I mean, you can't buy a computer today that 16, 18 months from now, you can't use it any longer. Technology is changing so fast. And you and I are formulating a career in the midst of technology that's changing faster than we're adapting to the change. In my own business experience, and what I'm doing right now, because we have businesses in Russia, is we've gone totally electronic. We are using the internet to transmit data, spreadsheets, information over the internet, so that when it gets into my office, from their computer to my office, it's live data at this end. And that data transfer process takes about 15 minutes. Guys, that's the world we're living in. And if you think in your career that you can kind of sit back and sort of coast a little while, when you realize and you wake up to realize you are a disposable asset, that once the value of your services can be placed at a lesser cost-effective way, you're going to be out in the marketplace. You're going to be out looking in the marketplace. Companies are concerned about productivity and getting more out of their employees, And so not only do you have to work more, harder, but we need to be working smarter. Item number six, sexual harassment. Let me just read these two verses to you, and then I want to tell you a real-life story that happened not 3 months ago, this year, 1996. For the lips of the adulteress drip honey, and smoother than oil is her speech, but in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as the two-edged sword. Ecclesiastes. And I discovered more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chains. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. Guys, I see routinely people that fall into problems in the workplace because of inappropriate relationships with women. This, not just a couple months ago, this year in the month of January, in fact it was, someone came to me and asked me if I knew about so-and-so. And I said, I knew so-and-so. I thought so-and-so was credible. Well, so-and-so had developed a friendship with his secretary. That friendship led him to do some extracurricular activities with his secretary. And pretty soon, old so-and-so had a bona fide relationship going on with her. Now, guys, that happens all the time. And you know, when you start thinking about what's happening in the corporate work site, that kind of stuff ain't tolerated. I mean, people lose their jobs over that. We have a company policy, zero tolerance for that kind of stuff. Zero tolerance. It means you don't get a second chance, you're gone. And when you think about the devastation on your family and you think about the problems of your reputation, I mean, suffice it to say there isn't a need to now worry about a platform for ministry because your whole life has been ruined. I read this book, a friend of mine gave this book to me. It's called Hedges by Jerry B. Jenkins, Loving Your Marriage Enough to Protect It. It's a real easy reading book. I highly recommend every one of you getting it. The first chapter in this book sets the stage of a typical business executive in a typical job with a female in a department of another part of the company, and they go to convention together. And at this convention, these are Christians, committed Christians, and they have fun together and they start relating and, you know, they're kind of enjoying they're away from their spouse and so they're kind of enjoying the opposite sex and they're over there. And it ends up where he divorces his wife and she divorces her husband and they are absolutely convinced it's God's will for them. Now, how in the world could it be God's will? Except that Scripture tells us it's dangerous beyond belief. And you and I have got to put not just one hedge between us and the female employees in our work site, but a number of them. And so, Jerry B. Jenkins. I'm sorry, I said Jerry Bridges. I'll leave it up here. I'll leave this book out. Guys, only read chapter one. Okay, just read how easy it can happen. I mean, it is not inconceivable. And then I read that book, and this friend of mine who's trapped in this situation, and I gave him this book. I said, just read chapter one. And he said, Dan, I need some serious help. And he did. He did need some serious help. Yes?
A question on the comment you made here. From, you're saying, from a Christian perspective or in the business world, there is very little tolerance for sexual promiscuity.
I'm talking about in general corporate environment. So, you know, small, medium-sized businesses may not be quite so quite such an issue. But if you're a public company, or if you're a big company, or even a medium-sized company, for example, we're in the insurance business, so we cannot afford to have any kind of a breach of moral conduct. That's what I'm referring to. And I'm not necessarily talking about sexual promiscuity as much as I'm talking about what happens in the workforce, what happens in your place, your particular work environment. That's what I'm talking about. And guys, I think that's where we're going to fall anyway. I don't think it's after work we have to worry about it. It's while we're at work. Undoubtedly, without a question, there's at least 20 to 25 women that come into my office every day. I don't have to worry about what happens after 5. It's 8 to 5 I have to worry about. And that's the caution I throw out to you guys. I'm going to skip for just a moment ethics and morality, except to say that, guys, in the general corporate marketplace, the moral code is totally situational ethics. Okay, so whatever is right today could be wrong to you. And let me just say to you that it's been my experience, and I talked with kind of our chief human resources person this past week, kind of talking these things through, and he said, you know, the greatest problem that I'm finding in even Christians as they apply the moral code to their business is sometimes something may be legal, but that don't make it right. You know, and you may have a contract that allows you to get out of a particular, there may be in a particular escape clause in a contract, and you've decided as you waded into it that this isn't what you want to do. And so you use that little opportunity, that little contract caveat that's in there to get you freed up from your commitment. Guys, don't be hung up on whether it's legal or not. Figure out, is it ethical or not? Is it right or not? Because that's the standard we live to, not the standard of whether or not it may be legal. I want to talk about competition and kind of end in our discussion of this. I want to mention competition because not only are we concerned about competitions among our contemporaries for jobs, but there's also other kinds of competitions that are coming, competition of internal markets in our company now. And we're a company that has about $1.5 billion in assets, about $800 million in annual revenues. We're kind of on the low end of the mid-sized companies. But in our company, what's happening is if you're not satisfied with the human relations department, if you're a profit center, you don't have to use them. If you can get human relations services provided from an outside consultant cheaper than our human relations department can offer that service to you, you're free to get that. Okay? So there's internal markets and there's external markets. And then competition because of the global marketplace, companies are being forced to compete on an international basis, and it's causing them to rethink how they treat you and what commitments they're making to you and what commitments they're making to their own customers. And we need to be thinking about what's happening within our own market and within the global marketplace. Now I want to talk about corporate cultures, and I want to talk about corporate cultures from the standpoint of you understanding what the rules are. And I really think here that that's the most important thing you need to figure out, is what are the rules? And the rules aren't always what's been published. All right? There's typically in companies I've been in, there's the published policies or rules the company issues, but then it's the unofficial code that the employees have. And you need to be aware of just understanding what goes on in your culture. Let me give you an example. This fellow I was talking to would get to work at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he would work till 6 o'clock at night. And he was using about an hour and a half at lunch for exercise, for jogging. He was jogging. And he began, the chief executive of our company, began to start gigging for some for using that time. And he began to feel some pressure to, in fact, he was outright told to do his jogging off company time. Now, mind you, it didn't make any difference to this business executive that he was working from 6 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night, and he was taking a half hour more in lunch. That wasn't the issue. The issue was this guy didn't want him jogging at lunchtime, because if he came in late, then the secretary would come in late, and that was his issue. Okay, and he didn't understand the culture. So, you know, his solution to it was, okay, he went home at 5 and he jogged in the morning. I think when I heard that story, it helped me realize that I need to understand and explore and thoroughly understand what's the corporate culture I'm working in. What is the unwritten code and the written code that makes things right and makes things wrong that work in your company? One of the things that's an application of this for me was, in our company, there's a big emphasis on being visible in the community. Visible. We want people to see you out in the community. And in fact, we're willing to pay. So I thought, well, how could I use that to figure out what I wanted to do? Well, it dawned on me, you know, I can probably get, if the customer doesn't buy my lunch, I can probably buy his lunch if I need to. Because I checked it with my boss. He said, yeah, if you're meeting with these people, I want to pay for that because I want you in the community. Secondly, I figured out, hey, would you mind if I bought a table at the mayor's prayer breakfast to invite business people in the community to come? No, we would love for you to do that. So all of a sudden, I started finding ways of getting, and I said, oh, hey, if I make a charitable donation to CBMC, because it's a 501, you need to learn these words, because it's a 501c3 qualifying organization, then can I get the company to match my donation? Sure, we'll match your donation. Figure out what's happening on the inside of your culture that gives you the opportunity to be able to leverage it to do the ministry. And then the last thing I want to talk about there, guys, is developing a platform or creating your personal credibility. And you might, that little guy that's holding that card up there, that's intended to be your scorecard. I don't know what your scorecard is in the industry, but that's what that's to represent. And two things came to my mind on creating your personal credibility. And the first is avoid the preoccupation with personal success. And I think each one of us have met people who are so preoccupied with their own attainment of their personal wealth accumulation or their reputation that it begins to be a big turnoff. We can easily fall into that trap. The two things that come to my mind about avoiding a focus on your own career development is, one, look to develop a team and help others buy into what you're trying to do. Build a team concept for what you're doing. One is that's going to make the people that are working for you, the colleagues in your organization, feel like their contribution is valuable to what the company's trying to do. And secondly, reward goal accomplishment. And then in the third point, create a supportive work environment. Create relationships that are based on trust. Conscientiously listen to the concerns and needs of others. Be courteous to subordinates. And then focus on the goals of the company, not interpersonal relationships. Guys, I think that is probably the best answer to the problem of having problem relationships with women in the workforce. Make sure that your relationship with them is constantly focused about what the company needs and what can you do as a team to accomplish the company goals. Stay away from what she needs or what her issues are or what your personal issues are. Keep your team-related relationship with her focused on what you can do together in accomplishing the company's goals. I think some of those things will help us develop credibility, credibility within our company and credibility in the marketplace in order to develop a ministry and hopefully make disciples. In developing ministry momentum on page 7 at the top, I've given you some words that I really feel like in my mind are kind of the quintessential words that describe making a disciple. The process of making a disciple is investing in people. And I'm going to avoid how to specifically do that, but I just want to give some words to you that kind of guide you along the path of seeing a relationship that begins at one point and makes a natural progressive change at the other point. Okay? And hopefully what you'll see is you'll see these words have some kind of logical conclusion. Identifying people. Every time I have lunch with somebody, I consciously ask myself, I wonder how they think about the gospel. I wonder, and I will oftentimes, in fact, as much as I can, I'll try to guide the discussion where I can find out what really is their interest level. And that's what I call identifying, getting them. Once I have found someone that I think is interested, then I try to recruit them. And I try to recruit them to, without any conversation about organizational stuff, you know, what I try to do is recruit them to have maybe breakfast or talk about Christ or And it's always in the context of me bringing something to them to help them with. And I have just chosen, maybe it's more a personal style, but I've decided, this my own conviction, if a guy won't memorize Scripture, he won't make disciples. I don't know that that's biblical, but I just have to tell you that that's my perspective. That's my conviction. And so I always take beginning with Christ with me. I just always do it. And we always talk about beginning with Christ, and we read the little booklet together, and then we work on a verse. And that's how I recruit them. And then serving, meeting their needs. Then leading, which has to do with setting an example and being a pace setter. And I don't know how you do this, but the way I do it is when I ask the guy to review beginning with Christ back with me, I'm memorizing 2 Timothy. I have him review me on 2 Timothy chapter 1 or 2 Timothy chapter 2. I'm just giving him the example to see what I'm doing. And he's more motivated to do his... If he sees that I'm working on an entire book of the Bible, he doesn't have a problem with getting one verse, typically. And then motivating them. And encouraging, to me, is a similar word. But when I think about motivating, what I'm trying to do is create within these guys an excitement and enthusiasm to get to know the God of the Bible and make the Scripture memory come alive and be exciting to them. And we're all the time talking about applications and how to make this stuff alive. And guys, it is partly our responsibility to motivate them to want to walk with God. And then develop them. Bring them along in their training and character development, and then sustaining them. And I had a difficult time trying to figure out, well, how to sustain guys in the ministry. I mean, I really didn't have a lot of I didn't have a lot of tools that I had developed to do that, and I had some prejudices that some things I would do wouldn't work. But the fella in Houston, I was flying down to Houston and spending a week down in Houston every month. And so when I was down there, the chief financial officer of this company and I, we started getting together. And he memorized the beginning of the Christ pack, and then he went on. And then all of a sudden, my trips to Houston became briefer. I mean, I wasn't down there as much. So I had to figure out how to get this guy to continue. And so we translated into telephone calls and Bible studies, and we use email, and we're writing letters, and I'm giving him kind of direction. I think you can keep guys going, and you can sustain them in the ministry by keeping on the telephone with them and keeping stuff going to them. Every time I get something emailed to me, I send it out to somebody that I know. I just want guys to know I'm working on staying in contact with them. I actively try to work on that. If I read something in a newspaper, I Xerox it and I send it to all these guys. So it is our responsibility to sustain them in the ministry, to keep them. Okay, so then is creating tools, creating a tool set. We're kind of getting close to being done, and I really only have one other thing to talk about. But in this concept of creating a tool set, guys, I think there's a lot of things that we have that we've learned that just because we've practiced them for a while, we're no longer acknowledging them as being a part of our equipment. For example, I was listening this morning. I went to a workshop on prayer, and been quite a long time, but I heard someone actually bring up the idea of using ACTS, A-C-T-S, to help somebody pray. I don't know how you guys do it, but every guy I talk to, I make ACTS, the little acronym ACTS, the most exciting thing about an appointment that we meet at. I mean, the whole breakfast is about how to use ACTS, and we'll talk about the pieces and what they mean and how to shift it around. You know what I'm saying? I'm trying to say I make an event out of some of these things with these guys. It's not just, oh, Joey, here's ACTS, and move on to the next agenda. What are the things that we have? Well, look, these are the things I know you guys probably have seen and done. But just the wheel illustration, the hand illustration. I was in Houston a few months ago. Well, it isn't the hand illustration, it's the drawing the bridge illustration out. We all know that, and we lose the perspective on how powerful that is. And back in the middle of last year, I went to Houston and with this fella, and I drew out the bridge illustration on a napkin, and I gave it to him, and we had a glorious time talking about it. And he was so excited that he took the bridge illustration home, and his stepdaughter that's living with him, he took the bridge illustration on the napkin, and he presented it to her, and she prayed and became a Christian. Because it's the simple stuff we have that is tools and equipping that we have that we just need to use. Things in My Heart, Christ Home booklet, Lessons on Assurance, Design for Discipleship, 7 Minutes with God. I was personally excited this morning to hear them talk about using 7 Minutes with God because it's a building block. I want to get the guy doing 7 Minutes with God faithfully before he's doing something else haphazard. And 7 minutes is reproducible. It is reproducible. Beginning with Christ, going on with Christ, topical memory system, 30 discipleship exercises. That's a Billy Graham publication. Born to Reproduce, booklet, Acts, Bible Highlights Reading Record. I made the copy out of, and I don't know, because I haven't seen a Colossians 2:7 series booklet anymore, I don't know if the Bible Highlights Reading Record is in there, but I made a copy of it, guys. Because I'll tell you, I've never seen any place else that teaches you how to mark your Bible. Right? Is there any other material that any of you have seen that says, okay, now you can underline and you can put brackets and you can use a highlighter and you can write it? Is there any other? I haven't seen that material out there. And so Bible Highlights Reading Record and how to mark your Bible, that becomes a foundational part of what I do with guys. It's just simple. Written Testimony, Steps to Peace, with God booklet, Tyranny of the Urgent. Those are things we don't even have to exercise a huge amount of creativity to recognize. Our toolbox is full of a lot of stuff we can do with guys. And this stuff is reproducible. It is simplistic, and it's challenging if you make it that way. Lastly, I want to kind of end with this personal growth development strategy. I'd been involved for more than 10 years in a team of men who were highly committed to making disciples, and we had a rigorous, rigorous involvement together. And when I felt like the Lord was leading me to something, doing a ministry in a different way, I felt void, I felt somewhat naked, a little exposed, kind of ill-prepared for being on my own. You know, I'd gotten to the point where I said, okay, am I now not one of those guys that can, quote, sort of be sent into the business world to do the ministry? You know, how long is it going to take for someone to keep coddling me before I'm held responsible to do what God has called me to do and these guys have equipped me to do? And I realized that I may be out there, but I ain't going to survive very long without a personal growth development strategy. And I just want to kind of call your attention to number 3 there, and that is develop yourselves a network of counselors or advisors. And when I was thinking about this, I read this little booklet, which really is good. It's called Connecting, and it's by Paul Stanley and Robert Clinton together. And what these two gentlemen did was to create kind of a flow, if you will, of involvement in an individual's life. And I've given you the outline at the bottom down there. It starts with a discipler. And the discipler has the most intense and high degree of accountability and involvement in a person's life, at least according to Paul Stanley. But then as you go down the list, you can start to see that what happens is this person who is this discipler in your life begins to start taking a different role. Now, guys, I think what happens in discipleship a lot is that we don't exactly know how to take these different roles. Because the kid that I've discipled, who now needs me to take a different role with him, because remember, it's not us that set the agenda for these guys. They're setting the agenda. They determine how long I'm going to help them. I'm not determining it, because he can quit anytime he wants. He can just quit performing on any of the stuff I want him to do, anytime he wants. So he's setting the agenda. So it was useful to me to see that a discipler becomes a spiritual guide, which becomes a coach, which becomes a counselor, teacher, model, and then sponsor. And guys, it's useful to me to see that when I have a relationship with a guide that starts at a discipler level, it's logical that at some point I'll become a sponsor. And that's what I was trying to describe to you about sustaining men in the ministry. It's you've got to shift your thinking because you need to support them in the ministry at some point. Now, they may have a lot of holes in their lives, but somebody else is going to have to fill that because your God-given role is moved to a sponsor. And that's not generally up to you to choose. They're the ones making the decision on how you're going to provide input into their lives. So that might be helpful to you just to see it. And then lastly, never allow yourself to not be learning something new. Okay, never. It's a kind of a double negative there, but never not. Get yourself and keep yourself in a position where somebody or somebody's around you is willing to make an investment in your life, even if it's periodic and even if it tends to be... I still have lunch with John from time to time, and I'll talk about my ministry plan that I'm doing. I'm talking about the... And John gives me feedback on what I'm doing. And guys, that kind of encouragement is what we need. And that kind of relationship is what we need. And you may need stronger involvement in your life, and you may not be ready for the sponsor level, but you can kind of figure out at what level you need to be supported. Okay, I think we're just about out of time, but I'd like to kind of let us go to a little bit of a question time. And so if you have some thoughts or you have some questions, even about some of the beginning material, I'd be glad to talk about that or discuss it a little bit. Okay. No questions? No thoughts? Okay.
How do you set, or do you set an agenda for your man, your discipling? Day one, day week three, month four, do you have a certain set agenda? Wow, sir.
I did develop, our team developed a very clear agenda for a person who is a follow-up. Week one, we do this. Week two, we do that. But for a disciple, we decided what a disciple needed to be by looking at the five verses in the New Testament where Jesus says, unless you do such and such, you cannot be my disciple. We figured out what those things were. Now, I look to the guy to be motivated in a particular area of his life. So I look to the area that he's motivated in, and I start there. So, something may be sequential on my piece of paper, but if he is needing help in the family, then I choose to work on that area with him.
Yeah, bud. I agree with that. I think that we can have a plan of what we're going to do week to week, but recognizing that the ultimate plan of the master plan of discipleship, so you've probably read, or of evangelism, the master plan of discipleship is Romans 8:28. What is God doing in this guy's life right now? What's he motivated by? How can I bring the word of God and his principle at that point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I've always got this structure that I know that I've got.
Yeah. And I'm really not hung up, Richard, anymore if I don't get a guy all the way through the syllabus. I'm really not hung up about that. I'm actually more exciting if I can make my contribution in that man and then be a part of the team that supports him long term. That's really now how I'm thinking about it. I only try to make the contribution I can make, and then I try to make sure that in the transition team, I'm a part of that for his long-term development and long-term counsel. I want to be in his circle of counsel. I want to be one of the guys that gives him long-term direction. So I'm more concerned about establishing that kind of relationship I am with a guy than I am necessarily trying to march him through my criteria. But, boy, I tell you, with a guy that I can march through the stuff, I do that. But I'm not personally hung up on it if I don't get there.
That's good. I find myself frustrated. I'm in the military. So I find myself, I think, 6 months ago after he's leaving, coming in, at best, every couple of years.
Yeah. I was exactly in that same situation when John put me out at Oklahoma City University and God created an international student ministry. I had 18 months from day one to when that student left for Taiwan to get them evangelized, saved, through follow-up, and hopefully with enough discipling stuff in their belt that they would go home and be effective. So, you know, compression, I understand that. And I would just say that you go back to the concept of focus. Anybody else? Yeah, John.
I have a question, Dan.
Okay.
I guess on creating a supporting work environment.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused here. On D, it says focus on the goals of the company and not interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
And in A, it says develop trust. And B, it says listen to other people. C, it says have mutual respect.
Yeah.
All those things sound like interpersonal relationships.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. When, let me clarify that. I probably didn't get it typed in here as clear as it should be. You have relationships with those employees. You're going to have relationships by virtue of the fact you're working together. Okay. So, since you're going to have those work relationships, they should be characterized by trust, by courtesy. But in terms of what you are trying to develop, what you're trying to create in your business, being her friend ain't the mission. I am not my secretary's friend. I am not the person that she goes to get help. I ain't that person, and she knows it. And we're friends on this kind of a basis, okay? So she knows in our relationship that I'll respect her and I'll provide a trust environment. But what I'm trying to do in the context of that business environment is accomplish the company's goals and not meet her personal issues or concerns. You know, I try to assist in the sense of directing her to Christian counselors, or because she's a divorced gal and she's got a kid, and so, you know, she's got all these kinds of problems. So I say, okay, well, here's a person I can help. But I don't try to solve those kind of issues myself. That's what I mean. Not trying to become the personal counselor yourself that solves those. But the trust issue there more has to do with, are you trustworthy in what you're doing and what you said to her? Can she count on what you said? That's what I mean by trust. I mean, are you trustworthy?
And this is to help you get your work done so that you can do your discipleship.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep. That is helping you create credibility. Yeah, Lonnie?
I think that's even good, too, on the same-sex relationships, that you have a dividing line of when we're in their office, we have a professional relationship. When I take you out to lunch, we can be buddies.
Yeah.
And I'm developing a good interpersonal relationship. How's the kids? And you know, how's your finances? How's your wife?
Yeah.
But when we're in the office, for the most part, it needs to really be focused on the company.
Yeah.
And that keeps you out of trouble.
Yeah. And plus, he's going to respect you.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't have the kind of work environment where you're free to kind of commingle that stuff, then you're not going to gain respect by concentrating on the wrong mission. Yeah. John, you had a thought or a question.
Dan, I'm just going to ask you to comment on the impact on personal prayer life of the men you're helping.
My personal prayer life. Well, that's a good question, John. I have an interpersonal intercessory prayer page on every guy that I meet with, and I have them on a. I hope this is answering the question. I rotate through their pages weekly, so there isn't probably a Bible study that goes by that these guys and I haven't prayed together, and that we haven't shared the kind of prayer requests. And I have become just a little bit of a stickler with some of the guys that come in and give me these very global kind of prayer requests, you know, like pray for my sister's aunt's nephew's uncle who's sick with, you know, I really want to pray for the guys in that area, but what do they really need? And if you can't get them to that point, they're not being open with you, and they're not being transparent. And so the kind of praying that I'm trying to do for the guys are the heart things that they're really needing prayer for. And I try to remain faithful to that, but I've used the intercessory prayer sheets to kind of give me the routine of doing it. And that really goes for the guys that are long distance too. And when I'm working with them on the phone, I pray with them on the phone every time, so they know that I'm trying to support them in prayer. Because it is one thing. One thing I've learned from John is that when he says, "I'll pray for you," what that means is you're about to be stopped in the parking lot, and he's going to pray right then. Because when John says he's going to pray for you, it doesn't mean he's going to go back to the office. It means go ahead and start bowing, you know, because it's coming.